Then, tearing the mutilated fragments out, I crammed them into my stove and watched them frizzle with savage delight. I have that frame still, but I have not yet had courage to paint a suitable subject for it.
The Vampire Maid by Hume Nisbet. Read by Eric Davies. It was the exact kind of abode that I had been looking after for weeks, for I was in that condition of mind when absolute renunciation of society was a necessity. I had become diffident of myself and wearied of my kind. A strange unrest was in my blood, a barren dearth in my brains. Familiar objects and faces had grown distasteful to me. I wanted to be alone. This is the mood which comes upon every sensitive and artistic mind when the possessor has been overworked or living too long in one groove. It is nature's hint for him to seek pastures new, the sign that a retreat has become needful. If he does not yield, he breaks down and becomes whimsical and hypochondriacal, as well as hypercritical. It is always a bad sign when a man becomes overcritical and censorious about his own or other people's work, for it means that he is losing the vital portions of work, freshness and enthusiasm. Before I arrived at the dismal stage of criticism, I hastily packed up my knapsack, and taking the train to Westmoreland, I began my tramp in search of solitude, bracing air, and romantic surroundings. Many places I came upon during that early summer wandering that appeared to have almost the required conditions, yet some petty drawback prevented me from deciding. Sometimes it was the scenery that I did not take kindly to. At other places I took sudden antipathies to the landlady or landlord, and felt I would abhor them before a week was spent under their charge. Other places, which might have suited me, I could not have, as they did not want a lodger. Fate was driving me to this cottage on the moor, and no one can resist destiny. One day I found myself on a wide and pathless moor near the sea. I had slept the night before at a small hamlet, but that was already 8 miles in my rear, and since I had turned my back upon it, I had not seen any signs of humanity. I was alone with a fair sky above me, a balmy, ozone-filled wind blowing over the stony and heather-clad mounds, and nothing to disturb my meditations. How far the moor stretched, I had no knowledge. I only knew that by keeping in a straight line, I would come to the ocean cliffs, then perhaps, after a time, arrive at some fishing village. I had provisions in my knapsack, and being young, did not fear a night under the stars. I was inhaling the delicious summer air, and once more getting back the vigor and happiness I had lost. My city-dried brains were again becoming juicy. Thus, hour after hour slid past me, with the paces, until I had covered about 15 miles since morning, when I saw before me in the distance a solitary stone-built cottage with roughly slated roof. "I'll camp there if possible," I said to myself as I quickened my steps towards it. To one in search of a quiet, free life, nothing could have possibly been more suitable than this cottage. It stood on the edge of lofty cliffs, with its front door facing the moor and the backyard wall overlooking the ocean. The sound of the dancing waves struck upon my ears like a lullaby as I drew near. How they would thunder when the autumn gales came on and the seabirds fled shrieking to the shelter of the sedges. A small garden spread in front, surrounded by a dry stone wall just high enough for one to lean lazily upon when inclined. This garden was a flame of color, scarlet predominating, with those other soft shades that cultivated poppies take on in their blooming, for this was all that the garden grew. As I approached, taking notice of this singular assortment of poppies and the orderly cleanness of the windows, the front door opened and a woman appeared who impressed me at once favorably as she leisurely came along the pathway to the gate and drew it back as if to welcome me. She was of middle age, and when young, must have been remarkably good-looking. She was tall and still shapely, with smooth, clear skin, regular features, and a calm expression that at once gave me a sensation of rest. To my inquiries, she said that she could give me both a sitting room and bedroom, and invited me inside to see them. As I looked at her smooth black hair and cool brown eyes, I felt that I would not be too particular about the accommodation. With such a landlady, I was sure to find what I was after here. The rooms surpassed my expectation. Dainty white curtains and bedding with the perfume of lavender about them. A sitting room, homely yet cozy without being crowded. With a sigh of infinite relief, I flung down my knapsack and clinched the bargain. She was a widow with one daughter, whom I did not see the first day, as she was unwell and confined to her own room. But on the next day she was somewhat better, and then we met. The fare was simple, yet it suited me exactly for the time. Delicious milk and butter with homemade scones, fresh eggs and bacon. After a hearty tea, I went early to bed in a condition of perfect content with my quarters. Yet happy and tired out as I was, I had by no means a comfortable night. This I put down to the strange bed. I slept certainly, but my sleep was filled with dreams so that I woke late and unrefreshed. A good walk on the moor, however, restored me, and I returned with a fine appetite for breakfast. Certain conditions of mind, with aggravating circumstances, are required before even a young man can fall in love at first sight, as Shakespeare has shown in his Romeo and Juliet. In the city, where many fair faces passed me every hour, I had remained like a stoic. Yet, no sooner did I enter the cottage after that morning walk than I succumbed instantly before the weird charms of my landlady's daughter, Ariadne Brunel. She was somewhat better this morning and able to meet me at breakfast, for we had our meals together while I was their lodger. Ariadne was not beautiful in the strictly classical sense, her complexion being too lividly white and her expression too set to be quite pleasant at first sight, yet, as her mother had informed me, she had been ill for some time, which accounted for that defect. Her features were not regular, her hair and eyes seemed too black with that strangely white skin, and her lips too red for any except the decadent harmonies of an Aubrey Beardsley. Yet my fantastic dreams of the preceding night, with my morning walk, had prepared me to be enthralled by this modern, poster-like invalid. The loneliness of the moor, with the singing of the ocean, had gripped my heart with a wistful longing. The incongruity of those flaunting and evanescent poppy flowers, dashing their giddy tints in the face of that sober heath, touched me with a shiver as I approached the cottage, and lastly, that weird embodiment of startling contrasts completed my subjugation. She rose from her chair as her mother introduced her, and smiled while she held out her hand. I clasped that soft snowflake, and as I did so, a faint thrill tingled over me and rested on my heart, stopping for the moment its beating. This contact seemed also to have affected her as it did me, A clear flush, like a white flame, lighted up her face, so that it glowed as if an alabaster lamp had been lit. Her black eyes became softer and more humid as our glances crossed, and her scarlet lips grew moist. She was a living woman now, while before she seemed half a corpse. She permitted her white, slender hand to remain in mine longer than most people do at an introduction, and then she slowly withdrew it, still regarding me with steadfast eyes for a second or two afterwards. Fathomless, velvety eyes these were, yet before they were shifted from mine, they appeared to have absorbed all my willpower and made me her abject slave. They looked like deep dark pools of clear water, yet they filled me with fire and deprived me of my strength. I sank into my chair almost as languidly as I had risen from my bed that morning. Yet I made a good breakfast, and although she hardly tasted anything, this strange girl rose much refreshed, and with a slight glow of color on her cheeks, which improved her so greatly that she appeared younger and almost beautiful. I had come here seeking solitude, but since I had seen Ariadne, it seemed as if I had come for her only. She was not very lively. Indeed, thinking back, I cannot recall any spontaneous remark of hers. She answered my questions by monosyllables and left me to lead in words. Yet she was insinuating and appeared to lead my thoughts in her direction and speak to me with her eyes. I cannot describe her minutely. I only know that from the first glance and touch she gave me, I was bewitched and could think of nothing else. It was a rapid, distracting, and devouring infatuation that possessed me. All day long I followed her about like a dog. Every night I dreamed of that white, glowing face, those steadfast black eyes, those moist, scarlet lips, and each morning I rose more languid than I had been the day before. Sometimes I dreamt that she was kissing me with those red lips, while I shivered at the contact of her silky black tresses as they covered my throat. Sometimes that we were floating in the air, her arms about me and her long hair enveloping us both like an inky cloud, while I lay supine and helpless. She went with me after breakfast on that first day to the moor, and before we came back, I had spoken my love and received her assent. I held her in my arms and had taken her kisses in answer to mine. Nor did I think it strange that all this had happened so quickly. She was mine, or rather I was hers, without a pause. I told her it was fate that had sent me to her, for I had no doubts about my love, and she replied that I had restored her to life. Acting upon Ariadne's advice, and also from a natural shyness, I did not inform her mother how quickly matters had progressed between us. Yet although we both acted as circumspectly as possible, I had no doubt Mrs. Brunel could see how engrossed we were in each other. Lovers are not unlike ostriches in their modes of concealment. I was not afraid of asking Mrs. Brunel for her daughter, for she already showed her partiality towards me, and had bestowed upon me some confidences regarding her own position in life. And I therefore knew that, so far as social position was concerned, there could be no real objection to our marriage. They lived in this lonely spot for the sake of their health, and kept no servant because they could not get any to take service so far away from other humanity. My coming had been opportune and welcome to both mother and daughter. For the sake of decorum, however, I resolved to delay my confession for a week or two, and trust to some favorable opportunity of doing it discreetly. Meantime, Ariadne and I passed our time in a thoroughly idle and lotus-eating style. Every night, I retired to bed meditating, starting work next day. Each morning, I rose languid from those disturbing dreams, with no thought for anything outside my love. She grew stronger every day, while I appeared to be taking her place as the invalid. Yet, I was more frantically in love than ever, and only happy when with her. She was my lodestar, my only joy, my life. We did not go great distances, for I liked best to lie on the dry heath and watch her glowing face and intense eyes while I listened to the surging of the distant waves. It was love made me lazy, I thought, for unless a man has all he longs for beside him, he is apt to copy the domestic cat and bask in the sunshine. I had been enchanted quickly. My disenchantment came as rapidly, although it was long before the poison left my blood. One night, about a couple of weeks after my coming to the cottage, I had returned after a delicious moonlight walk with Ariadne. The night was warm and the moon at the full, therefore I left my bedroom window open to let in what little air there was. I was more than usually fagged out, so that I had only strength enough to remove my boots and coat before I flung myself wearily on the coverlet and fell almost instantly asleep without tasting the nightcap draught that was constantly placed on the table and which I had always drained thirstily. I had a ghastly dream this night. I thought I saw Monster Bat, with the face and tresses of Ariadne, fly into the open window and fasten its white teeth and scarlet lips on my arm. I tried to beat the horror away, but could not, for I seemed chained down and thralled also with drowsy delight as the beast sucked my blood with a gruesome rapture. I looked out dreamily and saw a line of dead bodies of young men lying on the floor, each with a red mark on their arms, on the same part where the vampire was then sucking me. And I remembered having seen and wondered at such a mark on my own arm for the past fortnight. In a flash, I understood the reason for my strange weakness, and at the same moment, a sudden prick of pain roused me from my dreamy pleasure. The vampire, in her eagerness, had bitten a little too deeply that night, unaware that I had not tasted the drugged draught. As I woke, I saw her fully revealed by the midnight moon, with her black tresses flowing loosely and with her red lips glued to my arm. With a shriek of horror, I dashed her backwards, getting one last glimpse of her savage eyes, glowing white face, and blood-stained red lips. Then I rushed out to the night, moved on by my fear and hatred. Nor did I pause in my mad flight until I had left miles between me and that accursed cottage on the moor.
True Stories. The Sad Story of a Vampire by Eric Count Stenbach. Stanislaus Eric Count Stenbach, 1859-1895, was born in Estonia but studied at Oxford University before being forced to leave in disgrace after publishing a volume of homoerotic poems, Love, Sleep, and Dreams, 1881. He spent most of his short, strange life in England, founding the Idiots Club, which also had a branch in Estonia. He mixed Catholicism, Buddhism, and paganism in bizarre rituals, and his love for animals attained absurd levels that included bringing them to the dinner table. He was an abuser of opium and alcohol, leading to cirrhosis of the liver. Stenbach is scarcely remembered today, with his three volumes of suicidally sad, languid, supernatural, and perverted poems surviving in only single copies of their original editions. His only short story collection, Studies of Death, Romantic Tales, contained 7 stories and had a cover designed by Stenbock himself, depicting a graveyard scene. His clear, straightforward narrative style has been compared to Guy de Maupassant's. It was said that on the day he died in a drunken stupor, his face appeared at his uncle's window, echoing a similar incident in one of his poems. The sad story of a vampire was first published in book form in Studies of Death, Romantic Tales, London, Knott, 1894.
The Sad Story of a Vampire by Eric Count Stenbock, read by Susan Deniker. Vampire stories are generally located in Styria. Mine is also. Styria is by no means the romantic kind of place described by those who have certainly never been there. It is a flat, uninteresting country, only celebrated by its turkeys, its capons, and the stupidity of its inhabitants. Vampires generally arrive at night, in carriages drawn by 2 black horses. Our vampire arrived by the commonplace means of the railway train, and in the afternoon. You must think I am joking, or perhaps that by the word vampire I mean a financial vampire. No, I am quite serious. The vampire of whom I am speaking, who laid waste our hearth and home, was a real vampire. Vampires are generally described as dark, sinister-looking, and singularly handsome. Our vampire was, on the contrary, rather fair, and certainly was not at first sight sinister-looking, and though decidedly attractive in appearance, not what one would call singularly handsome. Yes, he desolated our home, killed my brother, the one object of my adoration, also my dear father. Yet, at the same time, I must say that I myself came under the spell of his fascination, and in spite of all, have no ill will towards him now. Doubtless you have read in the papers Passim of the Baroness and her Beasts. It is to tell how I came to spend most of my useless wealth on an asylum for stray animals that I am writing this. I am old now. What happened then was when I was a little girl of about 13. I will begin by describing our household. We were Poles. Our name was Ronski. We lived in Styria, where we had a castle. Our household was very limited. It consisted, with the exclusion of domestics, of only my father, our governess, a worthy Belgian named Mademoiselle von Erd, my brother, and myself. Let me begin with my father. He was old, and both my brother and I were children of his old age. Of my mother, I remember nothing. She died in giving birth to my brother, who is only 1 year, or not as much, younger than myself. Our father was studious, continually occupied in reading books, chiefly on recondite subjects, and in all kinds of unknown languages. He had a long white beard and wore habitually a black velvet skullcap. How kind he was to us! It was more than I could tell. Still, it was not I who was the favorite. His whole heart went out to Gabriel. Gabriel, as we spelled it in Polish. He was always called by the Russian abbreviation, Gavril. I mean, of course, my brother, who had a resemblance to the only portrait of my mother, a slight chalk sketch which hung in my father's study. But I was by no means jealous. My brother was, and has been, the only love of my life. It is for his sake that I am now keeping in Westbourne Park, a home for stray cats and dogs. I was at that time, as I said before, a little girl. My name was Carmela. My long, tangled hair was always all over the place, and never would be combed straight. I was not pretty, at least looking at a photograph of me at that time. I do not think I could describe myself as such. Yet, at the same time, when I look at the photograph, I think my expression may have been pleasing to some people. Irregular features, large mouth, and large wild eyes. I was, by way of being naughty, not so naughty as Gabriel in the opinion of Mademoiselle Von Erd. Mademoiselle Von Erd, I may interpose, was a wholly excellent person, middle-aged, who really did speak good French, although she was a Belgian, and could also make herself understood in German, which, as you may or may not know, is the current language of Staria. I find it difficult to describe my brother Gabriel. There was something about him strange and superhuman, or perhaps I should rather say preterhuman, something between the animal and the divine. Perhaps the Greek idea of the faun might illustrate what I mean. But that will not do either. He had large, wild, gazelle-like eyes. His hair, like mine, was in a perpetual tangle. That point he had in common with me, and indeed, as I afterwards heard, our mother having been of gypsy race, it will account for much of the innate wildness there was in our natures. I was wild enough, but Gabriel was much wilder. Nothing would induce him to put on shoes and socks, except on Sundays, when he also allowed his hair to be combed, but only by me. How shall I describe the grace of that lovely mouth, shaped verily en arc d'amour? I always think of the text in the psalm, "Grace is shed forth on thy lips, therefore has God blessed thee eternally." Lips that seemed to exhale the very breath of life. Then that beautiful, lithe, living, elastic form. He could run faster than any deer, spring like a squirrel to the topmost branch of a tree. He might have stood for the sign and symbol of vitality itself. But seldom could he be induced by Mademoiselle Von Erd to learn lessons. But when he did so, he learned with extraordinary quickness. He would play upon every conceivable instrument, holding a violin here, there, and everywhere except the right place, manufacturing instruments for himself out of reeds, even sticks. Mademoiselle Von Erd made futile efforts to induce him to learn to play the piano. I suppose he was what was called spoiled, though merely in the superficial sense of the word. Our father allowed him to indulge in every caprice. One of his peculiarities, when quite a little child, was horror at the sight of meat. Nothing on earth would induce him to taste it. Another thing which was particularly remarkable about him was his extraordinary power over animals. Everything seemed to come tame to his hand. Birds would sit on his shoulder. Then, sometimes, Mademoiselle Von Erd and I would lose him in the woods. He would suddenly dart away. Then we would find him singing softly or whistling to himself, with all manner of woodland creatures around him, hedgehogs, little foxes, wild rabbits, marmots, squirrels, and such like. He would frequently bring these things home with him and insist on keeping them. This strange menagerie was the terror of poor Mademoiselle Von Erd's heart. He chose to live in a little room at the top of a turret, but which, instead of going upstairs, he chose to reach by means of a very tall chestnut tree through the window. But in contradiction to all this, it was his custom to serve every Sunday Mass in the parish church, with hair nicely combed, and with white surplice and red cassock. He looked as demure and tamed as possible. Then came the element of the divine. What an expression of ecstasy there was in those glorious eyes. Thus far I have not been speaking about the vampire. However, let me begin with my narrative at last. One day, my father had to go to the neighboring town, as he frequently had. This time he returned accompanied by a guest. The gentleman, he said, had missed his train through the late arrival of another at our station, which was a junction, and he would therefore, as trains were not frequent in our parts, have had to wait there all night. He had joined in conversation with my father in the too late arriving train from the town, and had consequently accepted my father's invitation to stay the night at our house. But of course, you know, in those out-of-the-way parts, we are almost patriarchal in our hospitality. He was announced under the name of Count Vardalek, the name being Hungarian, but he spoke German well enough, not with the monotonous accentuation of Hungarians, but rather, if anything, with a slight Slavonic intonation. His voice was peculiarly soft and insinuating. We soon afterwards found out he could talk Polish, and Mademoiselle Vonner vouched for his good French. Indeed, he seemed to know all languages. But let me give my first impressions. He was rather tall, with fair, wavy hair, rather long, which accentuated a certain effeminacy about his smooth face. His figure had something, I cannot say what, serpentine about it. The features were refined, and he had long, slender, subtle, magnetic-looking hands, a somewhat long, sinuous nose, a graceful mouth, and an attractive smile, which belied the intense sadness of the expression of the eyes. When he arrived, his eyes were half closed. Indeed, they were habitually so, so that I could not decide their color. He looked worn and wearied. I could not possibly guess his age. Suddenly, Gabriel burst into the room. A yellow butterfly was clinging to his hair. He was carrying in his arms a little squirrel. Of course, he was bare-legged as usual. The stranger looked up at his approach. Then I noticed his eyes. They were green. They seemed to dilate and grow larger. Gabriel stood stock still with a startled look, like that of a bird fascinated by a serpent. But, nevertheless, he held out his hand to the newcomer. Vardalek, taking his hand, I don't know why I noticed this trivial thing, pressed the pulse with his forefinger. Suddenly, Gabriel darted from the room and rushed upstairs, going to his turret room this time by the staircase instead of the tree. I was in terror what the Count might think of him. Great was my relief when he came down in his velvet Sunday suit and shoes and stockings. I combed his hair and set him generally right. When the stranger came down to dinner, his appearance had somewhat altered. He looked much younger. There was an elasticity of the skin, combined with a delicate complexion, rarely to be found in a man. Before, he had struck me as being very pale. Well, at dinner we were all charmed with him, especially my father. He seemed to be thoroughly acquainted with all my father's particular hobbies. Once, when my father was relating some of his military experiences, he said something about a drummer boy who was wounded in battle. His eyes opened completely again and dilated, this time with a particularly disagreeable expression, dull and dead, yet at the same time animated by some horrible excitement. But this was only momentary. The chief subject of his conversation with my father was about certain curious mystical books which my father had just lately picked up, and which he could not make out, but Vardalek seemed completely to understand. At dessert time, my father asked him if he were in a great hurry to reach his destination. If not, would he not stay with us a little while? Though our place was out of the way, he would find much that would interest him in his library. He answered, "I am in no hurry. I have no particular reason for going to that place at all, and if I can be of service to you in deciphering these books, I shall be only too glad." He added with a smile which was bitter, very, very bitter. "You see, I am a cosmopolitan, a wanderer on the face of the earth." After dinner, my father asked him if he played the piano. He said, "Yes, I can, a little." And he sat down at the piano. Then he played a Hungarian csárdás, wild, rhapsodic, wonderful. That is the music which makes men mad. He went on in the same strain. Gabriel stood stock still by the piano, his eyes dilated and fixed, his form quivering. At last he said very slowly, at one particular motive, for want of a better word you may call it, the relâche of the csárdás, by which I mean that point where the original quasi-slow movement begins again. "Yes, I think I could play that." Then he quickly fetched his fiddle and self-made xylophone, and did actually, alternating the instruments, render the same very well indeed. Vardalek looked at him and said in a very sad voice, "Poor child, you have the soul of music within you." I could not understand why he should seem to commiserate instead of congratulate Gabriel on what certainly showed an extraordinary talent. Gabriel was shy, even as the wild animals who were tame to him. Never before had he taken to a stranger. Indeed, as a rule, if any stranger came to the house by any chance, he would hide himself, and I had to bring him up his food to the turret chamber. You may imagine what was my surprise when I saw him walking about hand in hand with Vardalek the next morning in the garden, talking livelily with him, and showing his collection of pet animals which he had gathered from the woods, and for which we had had to fit up a regular zoological gardens. He seemed utterly under the domination of Vardalek. What surprised us was, for otherwise we liked the stranger, especially for being kind to him, that he seemed, though not noticeably at first, except perhaps to me, who noticed everything with regard to him, to be gradually losing his general health and vitality. He did not become pale as yet, but there was a certain languor about his movements, which certainly there was by no means before. My father got more and more devoted to Count Vardalek. He helped him in his studies, and my father would hardly allow him to go away, which he did sometimes, to Trieste, he said. He always came back, bringing us presents of strange Oriental jewelry or textures. I knew all kinds of people came to Trieste, Orientals included. Still, there was a strangeness and magnificence about these things which I was sure even then could not possibly have come from such a place as Trieste, memorable to me chiefly for its necktie shops. When Vardalek was away, Gabriel was continually asking for him and talking about him. Then, at the same time, he seemed to regain his old vitality and spirits. Vardalek always returned looking much older, wan and weary. Gabriel would rush to meet him and kiss him on the mouth. Then he gave a slight shiver, and after a little while began to look quite young again. Things continued like this for some time. My father would not hear of Vardalek's going away permanently. He came to be an inmate of our house. I, indeed, and Mademoiselle von Erd also, could not help noticing what a difference there was altogether about Gabriel. But my father seemed totally blind to it. One night, I had gone downstairs to fetch something which I had left in the drawing room. As I was going up again, I passed Vardalek's room. He was playing on a piano, which had been specially put there for him, one of Chopin's nocturnes, very beautifully. I stopped, leaning on the banisters to listen. Something white appeared on the dark staircase. We believed in ghosts in our part. I was transfixed with terror and clung to the banisters. What was my astonishment to see Gabriel walking slowly down the staircase, his eyes fixed as though in a trance. This terrified me even more than a ghost would. Could I believe my senses? Could that be Gabriel? I simply could not move. Gabriel, clad in his long white nightshirt, came downstairs and opened the door. He left it open. Vardalek still continued playing, but talked as he played. He said, this time speaking in Polish, Nai umiem viracik jak saihi koham. My darling, I fain would spare thee, but thy life is my life, and I must live, I who would rather die. Will God not have any mercy on me? Oh, life, oh, the torture of life. Here he struck one agonized and strange chord, then continued playing softly. Oh, Gabriel, my beloved, my life, yes, life. Oh, why life? I am sure this is all but a little I demand of thee. Surely thy superabundance of life can spare a little to one who is already dead. No, stay, he said now, almost harshly. What must be, must be. Gabriel stood there quite still, in the same fixed, vacant expression in the room. He was evidently walking in his sleep. Vardalek played on, then said, Ah! With a sigh of terrible agony. Then very gently, Go now, Gabriel. It is enough. And Gabriel went out of the room and ascended the staircase at the same slow pace with the same unconscious stare. Vardalek struck the piano, and although he did not play loudly, it seemed as though the strings would break. You never heard music so strange and so heartrending. I only know I was found by Mademoiselle von Erd in the morning, in an unconscious state, at the foot of the stairs. Was it a dream, after all? I am sure now that it was not. I thought then it might be, and said nothing to anyone about it. Indeed, what could I say? Well, to let me cut a long story short, Gabriel, who had never known a moment's sickness in his life, grew ill, and we had to send to Graz for a doctor, who could give no explanation of Gabriel's strange illness. Gradual wasting away, he said. Absolutely no organic complaint. What could this mean? My father at last became conscious of the fact that Gabriel was ill. His anxiety was fearful. The last trace of grey faded from his hair, and it became quite white. We sent to Vienna for doctors, but all with the same result. Gabriel was generally unconscious, and when conscious, only seemed to recognize Vardalek, who sat continually by his bedside, nursing him with the utmost tenderness. One day I was alone in the room, and Vardalek cried suddenly, almost fiercely.
"Send for a priest at once! At once!" he repeated. "It is now almost too late."
Gabriel stretched out his arms spasmodically and put them around Vardalek's neck. This was the only movement he had made for some time. Vardalek bent down and kissed him on the lips. I rushed downstairs, and the priest was sent for. When I came back, Vardalek was not there. The priest administered extreme unction. I think Gabriel was already dead, although we did not think so at the time. Vardalek had utterly disappeared, and when we looked for him, he was nowhere to be found. Nor have I seen or heard of him since. My father died very soon afterwards, suddenly aged and bent down with grief. And so the whole of the Ronsky property came into my sole possession. And here I am, an old woman, generally laughed at for keeping, in memory of Gabriel, an asylum for stray animals. And people do not, as a rule, believe in vampires.
A Case of Alleged Vampirism by Luigi Capuana. Luigi Capuana, 1839 to 1915, was born in Mineo in the province of Catania in Sicily, the son of wealthy landowners. After graduating from the Royal College of Bronte, Catania, he attended the Faculty of Law at Catania from 1857 to 1860, resigning to become the secretary of the Secret Committee of Insurrection, later becoming chancellor of the Civic Council. He moved to Florence in 1864 to begin a serious literary career, although he had already released the highly important drama Garibaldi, 1861, in three cantos. It was in Florence where he became acquainted with the most respected Italian authors of the era, wrote critical essays for the Italian Review, became a theater critic for Nation, and wrote his first novella, Dr. Symbolus, which was published serially in a daily newspaper. He returned to Sicily in 1868. His novels and other works were among the first Italian examples of naturalism in literature. They had profound pathological and occult tendencies, as well as serious psychological themes, though they often were denounced for being merely pseudo-scientific. He had been influenced by the novels of Émile Zola and the idealistic philosophy of Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, and in turn influenced Giovanni Verga and Luigi Pirandello. He also wrote fairy tales for children. A Case of Alleged Vampirism was first published in Rome by Enrico Voghera in 1907, entitled The Vampire.
A Case of Alleged Vampirism by Luigi Capuana. Read by Robin Sachs. "It's no laughing matter," said Lelio Giorgi. "Why shouldn't I laugh?" replied Mongeri. "I don't believe in ghosts." "Neither did I once, and I'd still rather not," went on Georgie. "That's why I've come to see you. You might be able to explain whatever it is that's making my life a misery and wrecking my marriage." "Whatever it is? You mean whatever you imagine it is. You're not well. It's true that a hallucination is itself a fact, but what it represents has no reality outside yourself. Or to put it better, it's the externalization of a sensation, a sort of projection of yourself, so that the eye sees what it in fact does not see, and the ear hears sounds that were never made. Previous impressions, often stored up unconsciously, project themselves rather like events in dreams. We still don't know how or why. We dream, and that's the right word, with our eyes wide open. But one has to distinguish between split-second hallucinations, which don't necessarily indicate any organic or psychic disturbance, and those of a more persistent nature. But of course, that's not the case with you. But it is, with me and my wife. You don't understand. What we scientists call persistent hallucinations are those experienced by the insane. I don't have to give you an example. The fact that you both suffer the same hallucinations is just a case of simple induction. You probably must have influenced your wife's nervous system. No, she was the first. Then you mean that your nervous system, having a greater receptivity, was the one to be influenced. And don't turn up your poetical nose at what you please to call my scientific jargon. It has its uses. If you would just let me get a word in edgeways, some things are best let well alone. Do you want a scientific explanation? Well, the answer is that for the moment, you wouldn't get anything of the sort. We are in the realm of hypotheses. One today, a different one tomorrow, and a different one the day after. You're a curious lot, you artists. When you feel like it, you make fun of science. You undervalue the whole business of experiment, research, and hypothesis that makes it progress. Then, when a case comes along that interests you personally, you want a clear, precise, and categorical answer. And there are scientists who play the game out of conviction or vanity, but I'm not one of them. You want the plain truth? Science is the greatest proof of our own ignorance. To calm you down, I can talk of hallucinations, of induction, receptivity, words, words. The more I study, the more I despair of ever knowing anything for certain. It seems to happen on purpose. No sooner do scientists get a kick out of some new law they've discovered than along comes some new fact, some discovery that upsets the lot. You need to take it easy. Just let life flow by. What's happened to you and your wife has happened to so many others. It will pass. Why must you try and find out how and why it happened? Are you scared of dreams? If you just let me tell you, go on then, tell me, if you want to get it off your chest. But I warn you, it can only make matters worse. The only way to get over it is to busy yourself with other things. Get away from it. Find a new devil to drive out the old. It's a good saying. We did all that. It wasn't any good. The first signs, the first manifestations happened in the country, in our villa at Foscolara. We ran away from it. But the very night that we came back to town, it's natural. What distraction could you find in your own house? You ought to travel, stay in hotels, one day here, another day there, spend the whole day sightseeing, looking at churches, museums, go to the theatre, come back late at night, tired out. We did all that, too, but just the two of you on your own. You should have been with a friend, a party. But we were. It wasn't any good. It all depends on the party. But they were a lively crowd. Selfish, you mean, and there you were, isolated, I know. But we were lively, too, when we were with them. But you can hardly expect them to have come and slept with us. Then you were asleep. Really, I don't know what you mean anymore, dreams or hallucinations. To hell with your dreams and hallucinations. We were wide awake and completely sound in mind and body, just as I am now, if you would only let me get a word in edgeways. As you wish. Well, you could at least let me give you the facts. I know. I can imagine it all. The books are full of them. There could be small differences in detail, but they don't count. The essentials are the same. Can I even have the satisfaction of... You can. Hundreds of them. You are one of those who seem to want to lay up troubles for themselves, even make them worse. I'm sorry, that's stupid. But if it would please you... Quite frankly, you seem to me to be scared. Scared of what? A nice idea. Scared of having to change your mind. You've just said, I do not believe in ghosts. And what if I force you to believe in them? All right, then.
It will be a blow. What do you expect? We scientists are like that. We're men, after all. When our way of seeing things, of judging them, takes a knock, the intellect refuses to follow the senses. Even intelligence is a matter of habit. But now you have me with my back to the wall. All right, then. Let's hear your precious facts.
Well, said Lelio Giorgi with a sigh, you know already the unhappy background to my years in America. Louisa's parents were against our marrying, and they may well have been right. They were thinking above all of the economic situation of their future son-in-law. They had no faith in my abilities and were doubtful about my future as a poet. That slim volume of early verse was my worst enemy. I haven't even written, let alone published, any more from that day to this. Yet even now you called me poetical. The label stuck. Oh well.
Just like you writers to go right back to the remote beginning.
Don't get impatient. Listen. I had no news of Luisa for the 3 years I was in Buenos Aires. Then came that rich uncle's will, after he had nothing to do with me while he was alive. I came back to Europe, hurried to London, and flew here with £200,000 in my pocket, only to find that Luisa had been married for 6 months, and I was as much in love with her as ever. The poor girl must have given in to family pressure. At that time I might have done anything. All these details are important. I was stupid enough, however, to write her a letter full of violent reproaches. I never thought it could have fallen into the hands of her husband. The next day he turned up at my house, having realized the folly of my behavior, and determined to persuade me to calm down. He was calm himself. "I have come to give you your letter back," he said. "I opened it by mistake, not out of inquisitiveness, and it's just as well I did. I am assured that you are a gentleman. I have every respect for your distress, but I do trust you have no intention of needlessly disturbing the peace of a family. If you can bring yourself to think things over, you will realize that nobody wished to harm you intentionally. It was pure misfortune. You must see now where your duty lies, and I can tell you quite plainly that I am determined to defend my domestic happiness at all costs." He was pale as he spoke, and his voice trembled. "I must apologize for my indiscretion," I replied, "and to reassure you, I can add that tomorrow I shall be leaving for Paris." I must have been even paler than him. The words would hardly come. I held out my hand, he shook it, and I kept my word. 6 months later, I received a telegram from Luisa. "I am a widow. I still love you. And you?" Her husband had been dead for 2 months.
"Such is life. It's an ill wind."
"And that's what I somewhat selfishly thought. But it isn't always true. I had never been so happy in my life as I was on my wedding night and during the following months. We both of us avoided any mention of him. Luisa had destroyed every trace, not out of ingratitude, for he had done everything to make her happy, but because she was afraid that even the slightest memory would have upset me. And she was right. Sometimes the thought that someone else, however legitimately, had once possessed her made me tremble from head to foot. I could scarcely hide it from her. Often she must have sensed this, and her lovely eyes were clouded with tears. But how radiant she looked on the day she felt sure enough to tell me of the expected arrival of a child. I remember it clearly. We were drinking coffee. I was standing and she was sitting down, with a look of touching weariness. And that was the first time she had ever made any reference to the past. "How glad I am that this didn't happen then," she exclaimed. A loud crash was heard at the door, as if someone had struck it a blow with their fist. We leapt up. I rushed out to see what had happened, imagining it was one of the servants, but the adjoining room was empty.
"It could have been one of the beams in the house, shrinking in the heat."
That was how I explained it to Luisa, seeing how upset she was, but I was not convinced myself. I felt somehow disturbed. We waited some minutes, nothing happened.
But from then onwards I noticed that Louisa avoided being left on her own. She was still upset, though she would not admit it, and I dared not question her.
And now I see how you were both influencing each other without realizing it.
Not at all. A few days later, I was laughing at the whole episode and thought that Louisa's agitated state of mind was due to her condition. Then even she seemed to calm down. Eventually, the child was born. After a few months, however, I noticed that the old feeling of fear and terror had returned. At night, all of a sudden, she would cling to me, cold and trembling. "What is it? Are you ill?" I would ask anxiously. "I'm frightened. Didn't you hear?"
"No."
"Don't you hear?" she insisted the following night. "No." Though this time I had heard the sound of footsteps in the room, pacing up and down by the bed. I said no so as not to frighten her any more. I raised my head and looked around. It must be a mouse in the room. "I'm afraid. I'm afraid." And for several nights at the same time, the same shuffling, the same uncanny coming and going up and down by the bed. We lay and waited for it.
And your jangling nerves did the rest.
You know me. I'm not the sort to get worked up easily. I put up a brave show because of Louisa. I tried to explain things, echoes of distant sounds, accidental resonances in the structure of the villa. We went back to town. But that very night, the phenomena turned up again, worse than before. Twice the bedstead was shaken violently. I peered out. "It's he! It's he!" stammered Louisa, huddled under the bedclothes.
"If you don't mind my saying so," interrupted Mongeri, "I wouldn't marry a widow for all the gold in the world. Something of the dead husband always remains with her, in spite of everything. Your wife wasn't seeing his ghost. It's he is the he of the sensations he left behind him, purely physiological."
"Well, maybe so," replied Lelio Giorgi. "But in that case, where do I come in?"
"Suggestion. Now it seems perfectly plain.
Suggestion only at specified times in the middle of the night.
Just waiting for it to happen would be enough."
"Well then, how can the phenomena vary every time when my imagination isn't working at all?"
"That's what you think. The unconscious at work."
"Do let me go on." "Keep your explanations until I've finished. Just note that the following morning we were able to discuss the matter with relative calm. Louisa described her impressions and I told her of mine, in such a way that I was convinced that it could not have been an unpleasant trick played on us by our overexcited imaginations. The same blow on the bedstead, the same tugging at the sheets in the same circumstances, when I was trying to comfort her with a kiss and prevent her from crying, as if this itself had provoked the malice of the invisible person. Then, one night, Louisa flung her arms round my neck and whispered in my ear in a voice that made me shudder, 'He spoke.'
What did he say?"
"I couldn't hear."
"Now, he said you're mine."
And as I held her closer, I felt her being dragged violently away from me by two powerful hands, and I had to give way in spite of her resistance.
What resistance could she offer to what must have been her own behavior?
All right, but I felt it too, as something trying to stop her coming into contact with me. I saw her flung back with a jolt. Then she tried to get to her feet to go to the child who was sleeping in the cot at the foot of the bed. Then we heard the cot wheels squeaking and saw it tossed across the room, blankets flying in all directions. That wasn't a hallucination. We picked things up, made up the cot, and soon they were flying through the air again, and the child was whimpering with fear. 3 nights later, it was even worse. Louisa seemed drawn completely under his evil spell. She seemed unaware of me when I spoke to her, as if I were no longer there. She seemed to be talking to him, and I could tell from her replies what he was saying to her.
"But can it be his fault that you are dead?" "No, no, no, no. How could you think so? I poison you? That's monstrous. And what can the child have done to harm you? But why are you unhappy? I have prayed for you. Why don't you want my prayers? You want me? But how can you? You're dead.
I tried without success to shake her from the trance. Then she came to.
Did you hear that? She said. He says I poisoned him. You wouldn't believe that of me. Oh, God, what about the child? He'll kill him. Did you hear?
I heard nothing, but I was well aware that Louisa was not raving. She wept, clutching the child to her.
What shall we do? What shall we do?
But the child was all right. That must have reassured her.
What can you expect? This sort of thing would upset even the most strong-minded. I myself am not superstitious, but I'm not a free thinker either. I just don't have much time for religion. But in a case like this, and with my wife saying, I'll pray for you, I naturally thought of calling in a priest.
You had him exorcise it?
No, but I had a blessing said in the house with a fine sprinkling of holy water, as much to influence poor Louisa, if it really were a case of nerves, as anything. Louisa is a religious person. You can laugh. I'd like to have seen what you would have done in my place.
What about the holy water?
Useless. No effect at all.
Not a bad idea, though. Some nervous diseases can be cured that way. We had a case of a man who thought his nose was being stretched. The doctor went through all the motions of an operation without actually doing anything, and the man was cured.
But the holy water, in fact, made things worse. The next night, my God, I can't bear to think of it, this time he seemed to be taking everything out on the child. It was awful. When Louisa saw,
or thought she saw.
Saw, man, saw. And I saw, too, almost. She couldn't get near the cot. Something was holding her back. There she was, stretching out her hands to the child, while that thing, she described it to me, bent over the baby and did something horrible, its lips pressed to his mouth, sucking his blood. For 3 nights this ghastly process has been repeated, and the poor little thing, you wouldn't recognize him. He used to be so plump and rosy, and now, in only 3 nights, he's wasted away. This can't be imagination. Come and see for yourself.
So it could really be.
Mongeri thought for a few minutes, frowning. The sarcastic and somewhat pitying smile with which he had listened to Lelio Giorgi had vanished all of a sudden. Then he looked up and said,
So, it could really be...
Listen, I can't explain anything because I'm convinced there is no explanation. One can't be more skeptical than that. But I could give you some advice which might make you laugh, coming from me. Anyway, that's up to you. I'll do as you suggest at once.
You would need several days for what you have to do. I'll help you to cut it as short as possible. I don't doubt the facts you've put before me, and I ought to add that since science has come to examine this kind of problem, it too has been less skeptical. It has now become a question of trying to see this sort of thing as a natural phenomenon, but a physical problem, not a spiritual one. That's not our province. We leave that to priests or spiritualists. We are concerned with the flesh, blood, and bone that go to make an individual and disintegrate into their original elements when he dies. But then the question arises, does this disintegration, this cessation of organic function, end instantaneously with death, annulling all individuality? Or does this persist, in some cases, for any amount of time after death? One is beginning to suspect that this could be the case, and science is on the verge of coming round to popular beliefs. I have been studying for 3 years now the empirical remedies of old wives and witches, and I am coming to the conclusion that they are in fact the remnants of the ancient secret sciences, and also, even more likely, of the instincts we can still observe in animals. When man was closer to animals, he knew instinctively the medicinal value of certain herbs,
but as he evolved away from them, he lost this primitive use of certain faculties, and the tradition died out. Only the honest peasant women, in whom it was more deeply rooted, preserved some of these natural medicines, and I think that science should study them, for every superstition contains something more than mere popular error. I'm sorry about this digression. What scientists now admit that the existence of an individual does not cease at death, but only when actual decomposition of the body has taken place. Popular superstition has already acknowledged through the belief in vampires, and has even offered a remedy. Vampires are individuals, rare but not unheard of, who persist after death. You may look surprised, but this is a case, and not the only one, where science and popular superstition, or rather primitive intuition, find themselves at one. What is the only defense against this evil thing, this disembodied individual sucking the blood and life force from healthy individuals? The complete destruction of its former body. Where vampires have been known to occur, the victims have run to the grave, dug up the body, and burnt it. Then the vampire really does die, and the visitations cease. Now, you were saying that your child... Come and see him. You wouldn't recognize him. Louisa is going crazy, and I'm not far off myself. I keep saying to myself that it can't be true. It couldn't possibly happen. I even think... Well, if she did poison him, it was for my sake. It shows how much she loves me. But it won't work. The thought repels me. She repels me, even. All his doing. And the reproaches go on, I can tell by her replies. What? Poison you? How can you believe such a thing? Life has become impossible. For months now we have gone on like this. You were the first person I have dared to confide in. I'm desperate. I need help. And we would have put up with everything if it weren't for the child. As a friend and as a scientist, I give you this advice. Have the body cremated. Your wife will easily get permission, and I will help you to speed up the formalities. And science herself would not be ashamed to have recourse to somewhat empirical methods, trying out a remedy which might well be a superstition in appearance only. Seeking out the truth by unconventional methods. Cremate the body. Seriously, he added, seeing from the look in his friend's eye that he feared he was being treated like one of the ignorant populace. But what about the child? Cried Lelio Giorgi, wringing his hands. One night I lost my temper and threw myself at him, yelling, Get out! For God's sake, get out! But I was stopped dead in my tracks, unable to move, mumbling with the words drying up in my throat. You can't imagine. Would you allow me to accompany you tonight? I hardly dared to ask you such a favor, but perhaps it would upset him even more. Would you leave it until tomorrow? But the next day he returned in such shattered state that Mongeri really wondered if he had gone out of his mind. He knows, stammered Lelio Giorgi. God, what a night! He swore he would do the most terrible things if we dared to. All the more reason for daring, replied Mongeri. If you had seen the cot tossed about, I don't know how the poor child survived. Louisa had to get down on her knees to him, weeping, I will be yours, all yours, only please don't hurt the child. And I felt at that moment that every link with her was broken, that she belonged to him again, and not to me. Calm down. We shall get rid of him. Let me come around tonight. Mongeri went, thinking, convinced that his presence would keep the vampire away. It's always the case. A neutral, indifferent force will counteract the unknown thing. We don't yet know how or why, but continued observation and study will show. And in the early hours of the night, this seemed to be the case. Louisa looked anxiously around, but nothing happened. The child slept untroubled in his cot, pale and wan. Lelio Giorgi did his best to conceal his worry, but kept glancing fearfully from his wife to the complacent Mongeri. They kept up a conversation on various topics.
Mongeri was describing some highly amusing incident on one of his holidays. He was a good talker, without any of his professional pomposity, and he hoped to distract the attention of both of them so that if the phenomenon did occur, he could observe it uninterrupted, when suddenly, as he glanced at the cot, he noticed a slight movement which could not have been caused by either of the parents, since they were sitting at the other side of the room. He stopped, and they leapt to their feet. By the time they had followed his gaze to the cot, it was rocking with some violence. Louisa cried, "Oh, heavens, my poor child!" and rushed towards the cot, but was stopped short and sank back onto the couch. Pale as death, she rolled